of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for April 13th, 2024. I'm your reader, Katie Davis. Here's our first story. On the main page on A1, the largest article appears to be one titled Walks in Kindness. Our Clear Creek Amana teacher, A-M-A-N-A, Amana Amana teacher, Walks in Kindness, Thomas Braverman, who's worked with special ed students for 35 years, is Teacher of the Year finalist. Article is by Grace King for the Gazette. Tiffin. In Thomas Braverman's classroom, students 18 to 21 years old learn how to shop for groceries. They make their own lunches at school. They learn how to use public transportation to get to jobs. Braverman, a special education teacher for 35 years in eastern Iowa, is a finalist for this year's Iowa Teacher of the Year Award from the Iowa Department of Education. The award recognizes teachers who take teaching beyond textbooks and who inspire their students and peers. I believe every student, regardless of their disability, has something they can give back. I also believe learning is always reciprocal, and I've learned more from my students than they will ever learn from me, said Braverman, who oversees the transition program in the Clear Creek Amana Community School District. Braverman, 60, said his students, quote, demonstrate to me every day, end quote, what is important in life. Love, forgiveness, understanding other people, and being tolerant of others. Tolerant of other people's differences and having sustained relationships. As a youth, Braverman went to Iowa City Schools, where he said he was considered an at-risk student. I spent a lot of time in the parking lot hanging out with people I probably shouldn't have, he said. He left high school and obtained his high school equivalency diploma through Kirkwood Community College. While taking Kirkwood continuing education classes, he began working at a group home with young adults. A lot of the people I was working with probably could have learned more skills at an early age to make them more independent, Braverman said. He discovered helping people gain those skills and work toward independence was what I really wanted to do. A friend encouraged him to apply to be a paraprofessional at Iowa City West High School. He got the job. More than a decade later, a West High administrator encouraged him to go to college and earn a teaching degree. He did that and worked almost 20 years in the Iowa City District as a teacher and para-educator. He also worked in the West Branch and Solon School Districts. While teaching at Iowa City High, Braverman developed a community-based work experience program where special education students could intern at more than 50 businesses. The real-world work skills they learned set them on a course toward more independent living after high school. His work at City High led to his Teacher of the Year nomination. Braverman began teaching at Clear Creek Amana after taking an early retirement package last year when the Iowa City District cut its budget. Today, Braverman oversees the Clear Creek Amana transition program for students who have met the requirements to graduate from high school but need skills to live independently. The whole idea is to help them transition into life after high school as successfully as possible, Braverman said. With the help of Braverman and paraprofessionals, the students learn these life skills and gain workplace readiness skills. Most of the students have paid jobs they go to daily. The students also volunteer at places such as the North Liberty and Coralville food pantries and Colonial Manor, a retirement community in Amana where they visit every Friday to play bingo with the residents. I believe every student, regardless of their disability, has something they can give back, Braverman said. Joey Glass, creative director at Colonial Manor, has worked with Braverman to place students in jobs for almost a decade. Braverman, he said, walks in kindness. Mark Moody, principal of Clear Creek Amana High School, said Braverman has brought a wealth of knowledge, experience, and connections to the district in its Transition Alliance programs. For some kids, you may need to try four or five different times before finding a good fit at a work site, but he has those connections and patience to work with employers and students to find a good fit, Moody said. Braverman said he helps students set goals that both challenge them and are realistic. He works with the students and their families on services available to them after high school, such as group homes or assisted living facilities, if that's the support they need. or facilities, excuse me. Braverman gives the paraeducators who work with him a lot of credit for the transition program. The paras are a huge extension of me as an educator, he said. They are my left arm and my right arm. We would never be able to do this work without them, Braverman said. Julie Gunnels, a paraprofessional at the district's Transition Alliance Center, said Braverman understands his students on every level. He always shows them a lot of respect, but even if they're having a bad day. This also is connected to a photo. It's one of two men. One, they are both sitting at a desk in what appears to be like a classroom setting. One has a big gray beard and a blue button-up shirt and a lanyard and glasses, a kind of propped on his top of his head. And the other man wears a long blue, like, turtleneck with, like, a white bib and short cropped brown hair, and he's eating from a bowl that might be salad. And the photo is captioned, "Teacher Thomas Braverman Wright talks with student Jason Snow, 21, while they eat the lunch they prepared Friday at the Clear Creek Kamana Community School District in Tiffin. Braverman, who's worked with special education students in eastern Iowa for 35 years, is a finalist for this year's Teacher of the Year Award from the Iowa Department of Education. All right. To the side of this, in a column on the right, is an article titled "CR Seeks Grants for 5 Hybrid Electric City Buses. City Favors Transitioning to Hybrid, Not Fully Electric Buses." Article by Marissa Payne for the Gazette. Cedar Rapids. After completing a plan guiding Cedar Rapids' transition to Iowa emission vehicles in the city's quest to be carbon-free by 2050, city officials are opting to seek federal funding to add 5 hybrid electric buses to their transportation fleet. The Cedar Rapids City Council this week signed off on a resolution supporting the Iowa Department of Transportation's application to the Federal Transit Administration for its fiscal 2024 low or no emission grant program, which offers competitive grants for purchasing low or no emission buses. Cedar Rapids Transit is looking to replace 5 2011 model diesel buses with 5 new hybrid electric buses through the program. The city typically replaces 2 of its 30 or so buses each year. Hybrid diesel electric buses have a more modern, sleek appearance than normal buses and store energy captured during coasting and braking. They have geofencing technologies that can kick the bus into electric mode when they reach certain zones. They also have a start/stop mode, allowing the diesel generator to power off when the vehicle comes to a full stop. This is the right way to go at this time, Cedar Rapids Transit Manager Brad DeBrower said. It makes sense for us to do it in both an environmentally and fiscally responsible manner. In December, consultant 1898 and company helped the city finalize a zero-emission transition plan for Cedar Rapids Transit. Should the city incorporate electric buses into its fleet, this plan identifies resources to make that transition possible. The federal government requires transit agencies to draft such a plan to seek federal grants that subsidize the cost of purchasing the vehicles. If the grant is approved, it's anticipated the fiscal 2026 transit budget would include the necessary 15% local match, and the buses would likely arrive by fiscal 2023 or 2027. The local funding would come out of transit reserve funds. The new buses first would be placed on Route 5, the most used route that operates on First Avenue at a 15-minute frequency. The route serves environmental justice communities, neighborhoods that are either more racially diverse or a lower socioeconomic status, or of a lower socioeconomic status. Then two other buses would likely go on Route 8, mostly serving Southwest Cedar Rapids or the next busiest routes. I've been saying routes, but it might be routes. When they looked at demographics, switching over was going to end up benefiting the populations that are disproportionately impacted, DeBrower said. Prioritizing the biggest, busiest routes also helps maximize environmental benefits and would curb carbon dioxide emissions the most, he said. City officials have been wary of transitioning to fully electric buses as other communities in Iowa and Minnesota have faced issues with these vehicles not being reliable in extreme cold weather. In Des Moines, for instance, electric buses have been pulled off city streets since November 2022 because of maintenance issues. If Cedar Rapids Transit faced similar operational issues, DeBrower said the city would have to scale back service, but hybrid buses would operate in extreme weather without losing the charge. Proterra, the nation's leading electric bus manufacturer, also has filed for bankruptcy protection, raising concerns about the instability of the electric vehicle market at a time when the federal government is moving to curb greenhouse gas. Raising concerns about the instability of the electric vehicle market at a time when the federal government is moving to curb greenhouse gas emissions. Plus, DeBrower said, the vehicles would cost over $2 million to purchase, and the technology such as charging infrastructure to support them is quickly evolving and costly to keep up with. With that in mind, DeBrower said, hybrid buses offer more reliable performance without assuming extra infrastructure and purchase costs of electric buses. If the city is successful in transitioning to the hybrid buses, the study explored using buses manufactured by either Gillig or New Flyer. DeBrower said the city would stick with Gillig, its current bus manufacturer. After expanding the fleet beyond these five buses in the future, DeBrower said staff would take a step back and make sure they'd be performing the way we're hoping they would and look at funding. Currently, buying two of Gillig's diesel buses costs about $615,000 a year, DeBrower said, but prices have risen since the COVID-19 pandemic began. The hybrid buses cost over $1 million per vehicle. While inflation is driving up fuel costs, DeBrower said hybrid buses would help reduce city spending on fuel and maintenance costs. The bus fleet parks at local locations, the Transit Bus Garage on 8th Street Northwest, the Ground Transportation Center downtown, and the Twix Town Road Transfer Point in Northeast Cedar Rapids. Hybrid buses would have to be parked at the first two locations, which support electric vehicle charging infrastructure. If expanding electric buses throughout the metro area in the future, the city could revisit infrastructure at the Twix Town Road facility. In Iowa City, which has four electric buses, Transportation Services Director Darian Nagelgom said in an email, the city plans to replace all diesel buses with electric ones as they age out. All electric vehicles, including the city's buses, have decreased range, miles driven on a full charge during extreme cold, she said. Practically speaking, we need to return them to the facility sooner in the day for recharging during the coldest days, Nagelgom said. Otherwise, they do fine in the cold. This time of year, we get the best range when we are not running the heat or the air conditioning. We expect the cold weather range concerns to diminish as battery technology advances. Iowa City received a $23 million Federal Transit Administration grant to expand its electric bus fleet and help fund a new transit facility built for a full electric bus transition. Nagelgom said the city is beginning to design process this year, and anticipates providing transit services from the new facility in the next 3 to 4 years. As you can probably guess, that column spilled over into, page 6A. The final article on A1 is one near the top. It's titled, Plan Calls for Fewer Law Officers at State Parks, but the park rangers who are upgraded won't have other duties. Article by Aaron Jordan. The Gazette, Iowa, would have 18 fewer law enforcement officers under... Oh, by Aaron Jordan for the Gazette. There is some strange typography there. Iowa would have 18 fewer law enforcement officers under a plan the Iowa Department of Natural Resources is using to phase out park rangers at its state parks. The plan, which the Gazette obtained this week, calls for gradually eliminating all 35 park ranger roles across the state. About half of these positions would be reclassified as conservation officers who patrol a county or counties instead of specific parks, and half would become park managers or technicians. The Iowa DNR says this move will consolidate law enforcement staff and won't harm public safety in Iowa's 69 state parks. Some state park advocates disagree. Dave's son was a ranger and lived in Backbone State Park near Dundee in northeast Iowa for 24 years before retiring in 2020. He fears the changes rule will result in a reduced law enforcement presence at the state parks, as regional conservation officers will have to enforce Iowa laws across broad geographic areas. If they are going to be called over a county, they're not going to spend any time in the park, Sun said. During his 2 decades at Backbone, popular with hikers, climbers, and campers, Sun stuck around the campground from 8 p.m. to midnight most weekend nights in the summer. His presence sometimes was enough to send rowdy folks packing. "We could go and talk with a group before things got out of control," he said. "It's not that I wrote a lot of citations, but I was there. People knew I was there." Conservation officers are responsible for enforcing the law at state parks and on other public lands, including 410,000 acres of wildlife management areas and several off-highway vehicle parks across the state. The state also has 8,000 miles of groomed snowmobile trails. Seasonal staff working in state parks become sworn officers during warm weather months, but they have authority to enforce only misdemeanors and would need to call other law enforcement officers for more serious crimes. Johnson County Sheriff Brad Kunkel said he would be concerned if the Iowa DNR reduces law enforcement at Lake McBride State Park near Solon, which is more than 100 campsites and 2 campgrounds, a beach, and 12 miles of hiking trails. "As a larger park, I would hope that staffing would be a priority," Kunkel said. "The bulk of our assistance at Lake McBride happens during the overnight hours or on serious incidents like a drowning. We'll have to wait and see if these recent changes affect past practice." The Iowa DNR says the switch actually will mean more law enforcement in state parks during the summer. Previously, park rangers' duties included a mix of law enforcement, resource management, and faculty maintenance, Pete Hildreth, the agency's Conservation and Recreation Division administrator, said in an email Friday to the Gazette. They will now be 100% assigned to law enforcement. "This change alone increases the amount of law enforcement in parks, coupled with the addition of conservation officers' presence in state parks. There will be an increase in the number of officers at state parks during the recreation season." The Iowa DNR has said the plan isn't about saving money. The average salary for Iowa conservation officers in fiscal 2023 was about $94,500, according to the state salary book. Park rangers earn just under $80,000 on average, so the rangers who become conservation officers would be paid more, leading to higher costs in the job category. Before the 18 positions reclassified as park manager or technicians, the pay range is $43,600 for lower-level technicians to $59,700 for park managers. Whether the plan saves money depends on how the new positions are classified. The Iowa House Agriculture and Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee this week added $250,000 to the proposed budget for next fiscal year to improve accessibility in Iowa's state parks. This was after the Gazette and other news outlets reported the parks have many shelters, restrooms, playgrounds, and beaches that can't be accessed by people with disabilities. The full House now will vote on this budget. The Iowa Senate has so far not allocated new funding for accessibility. Overall, Iowa state parks need $100 million in infrastructure repairs and improvements, according to a presentation given last fall to Iowa DNR staff. Among noted deficiencies are shelters with rotten support beams, storm damage, cracked sidewalks, ungrounded electrical outlets and septic systems, and sewage lagoons that need to be replaced. Representative Sammy Sheets, Democrat for Cedar Rapids, asked the Iowa DNR for information about the infrastructure needs and why Director Kayla Lyon did not ask for more money in her budget request. This bureau manages a 5-year budget with the goal of spending approximately $5 million annually on high-priority and costly projects, Sheets said. While this approach targets critical needs, it does not encapsulate all the needs across our parks system, as demonstrated by the $16 million in repairs identified in DNR documents and the even more substantial $100 million noted by a former employee. Sheets, who serves on the Appropriations Subcommittee, said the agency should revamp its funding model to include a comprehensive needs assessment that prioritizes improving accessibility. There is a photo, small photo, of a building with like a shed on two sides and windows near the top and near the bottom and sort of on a hill surrounded by trees. It's captioned, "A latrine in Palisades Kepler State Park near Mount Vernon is not handicapped accessible because it's on a hill without compliant walkways." All right. On page 2A2, it's just in two ads and a photo of a group of what I think is high school boys running for track and field. And there's like a very wide, beautiful rainbow in the sky behind them. And the photo is titled, "A Rainbow Frames William Berg's Colin Reed and Independence Carson Cameron During the Thursday Sprint Medley Relay at the Benton Community Invitational Track Meet at Benton Community Middle School / High School in Van Horn. The forecast shows little chance of rainbows this weekend, but lots of sunshine Sunday by way of compensation." And the photo is taken by Jeff Stelfox for the Gazette. On A3, we have column ad. It's titled, "Bloody Knife Used to Kill Man Found in His Kitchen. Ex-girlfriend of accused killer testifies he had suicidal intent." Article by Trish Mahaffey for the Gazette, Cedar Rapids. "A retired crime scene investigator testified Friday he found two paths of blood droplets from the bed where Dennis First's body was found in May 2007. To his apartment's kitchen, where he found blood-soaked oven mitts and a paring knife with a 3-4-inch blade believed to be the murder weapon. Jim Kelly, the retired Cedar Rapids investigator, testified he found the paring knife with blood on its blade and handle in a kitchen drawer. He said he also found blood on a small knife sharpener in the same drawer. No prints were found on the knife, and only a partial print was found on the knife sharpener. That partial print matched the left index finger of Curtis Padgett, who is on trial in Linn County District Court this week, accused of killing First, 64, on May 11, 2007. Padgett, 42, is charged with first-degree murder. He lived downstairs from First in the Hawthorne Hills apartment, 2249 C Street Southwest. C might be... I don't know what C is. He is accused of severely beating First and fatally stabbing him in the neck that day. According to testimony, First was found dead on his apartment's pull-out sofa's bed with his face, head, and neck covered in blood. Padgett waived his right to a jury trial and opted for a bench non-jury trial. 6th Judicial District Court Ian Thornhill will decide the verdict. First's slaying was a cold case until March 2023 when Padgett was charged, but no one has yet testified what evidence led to Padgett's arrest. The prosecution should wrap up its case Monday when the defense should start. Kelly said he found the oven mitts in a drawer next to the stove and the paring knife in a drawer on the other side of the stove in First's apartment. The outside of the drawer holding the oven mitts also had blood on it, Kelly said. The other knives in the drawer with the bloody paring knife did not have blood on them, and most were in sheaths, he said. Kelly said First body had been removed before the crime scene investigators started collecting evidence. He said he found a knife stab in the bed's fitted sheets and mattress pad where First was lying. No sign of forced entry was found in First's apartment, he said. Kelly said he found partial prints by the wall thermostat, but they weren't identifiable. Footwear impressions also were gathered. One unique pattern found in a blood spot matched a lug sole boot found in First's apartment, Kelly said. A box was found for the boots, which had been purchased April 26, 2007, according to receipt in the box. Rod Shiflett, a Cedar Rapids police crime scene investigator who was at First's apartment in 2007, testified he focused on the bathroom in his search of the apartment. He said he found blood in a loofah sponge in the shower and on the shower head. Paget's ex-girlfriend, Catherine Zimmerman, testified that Paget made suicidal attempts during Memorial Day weekend in 2010. He had been drinking alcohol and they were arguing. At one point, Paget put a knife to his neck and said that was how Dennis died. At another point on the anniversary of First's death, she said Paget was crying. She asked him if he'd killed First. He denied it. She said that Paget also told her, "I wouldn't tell you because you would go snitch on me." Zimmerman said she and Paget dated from March 2007 to 2009 and then briefly got back together for about a month in 2010. She said Paget once told her he blacked out when he was talking to First. He would sometimes drink to the point of not being able to remember what happened after he sobered up, she said. On cross-examination, Zimmerman admitted she didn't tell police about the Memorial Day incident until police reached out to her in November 2011. Police contacted her again January 5th, 2012, asking if she would let them look at her computer. Zimmerman agreed, but said nothing was on it regarding First death or Paget. Zimmerman said the last time police contacted her was in 2022. She told them she didn't want to get involved because she just had a baby. This is, attached to this article is a photo of a man in a gray suit and tie sitting at a desk with a microphone and what I think is like a jug of water. He sits in like a courtroom setting. There seems to be like gadgets and wires and notepads on the desk. It's captioned Curtis Paget 40. Oh, and the man is short, cropped, brown hair. Curtis Paget 42 of Cedar Rapids is shown Thursday in Linn County District Court in Cedar Rapids during his first degree murder trial. He is accused of beating and fatally stabbing Dennis First 64 on May 11th, 2007 when the two lived in the Hawthorne Hills apartment complex in Cedar Rapids. There's also a photo of the judge sitting in his robes in front of a flag. It's captioned, "Iowa 6th Judicial District Judge Ian Thornhill looks on Thursday during the first-degree murder trial of Curtis Paget in Linn County District Court in Cedar Rapids." You are listening to the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Catherine Davis. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at 515-243-6833, 515-243-6833. A4 is the Nation and World section. A larger article up in the top left corner is titled "Trump Gives Support to Embattled House Speaker," article by the Associated Press, Palm Beach, Florida. Donald Trump offered a political lifeline Friday to House Speaker Mike Johnson, saying the beleaguered GOP leader is doing a very good job in tamping down the far-right forces led by Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene trying to oust him from office. Trump and Johnson appeared side by side at the ex-president's Mar-a-Lago club, a rite of passage for the new House leader as he hitches himself and his GOP majority to the indicted Republican Party leader ahead of the November election. "I stand with the speaker," Trump said at an evening news conference at his private club. Trump said he thinks Johnson of Louisiana is doing a very good job. He's doing about as good a job as you're going to do. "We're getting along very well with the speaker, and I get along very well with Marjorie," Trump said. But Trump flashed some criticism over efforts to oust the speaker, saying there are much bigger problems right now. The visit was arranged as a joint announcement on new House legislation to require proof of citizenship for voting, but the trip itself is significant for both. Johnson needed Trump to temper hardline threats to evict him from office, and Trump benefits from the imprimatur? I don't know this word. I-M-P-R-I-M-A-T-U-R. Imprimatur? Of official Washington dashing to Florida to embrace his comeback bid for the White House and his tangled election lies. Johnson and Trump underscored their alliance Friday by using similar wording to describe one part of their campaign strategy, pummeling President Joe Biden over what Republicans claim is a migrant invasion. By linking the surge of migrants coming to the U.S. with the upcoming election, Trump and Johnson raised the specter of non-citizens voting, even though it's already a felony for a non-citizen to vote in a federal election and exceedingly rare. Trump called America a dumping ground for migrants coming to the U.S. and revived pressure on Biden to close the border. The speaker nodded along. "It could, if there are enough votes, affect the presidential election," warned Johnson, who had played a key role in challenging the 2020 election that Trump lost to Biden, previewing potential 2024 arguments. Attached to this article is a photo of Donald Trump at a podium. Standing behind him is Mike Johnson. They are at Mar-a-Lago, and this sort of, like, I want to say platform, open ceiling kind of place with, there are big arches and fancy columns and a Baroque kind of table with candlesticks around it, and big American flags, too, so it's standing in the back. In a column to the side of this, in the right side of the page, is an article titled U.S. Braces for Imminent Iran Attack on Israel, article by the Los Angeles Times, Washington. The U.S. and its allies are sounding an unusually urgent alarm over Iran's possible plans to retaliate in the coming days over Israel's purported killing of senior Iranian officials at the diplomatic mission in Syria. An Iranian action, it is feared, would likely provoke an Israeli response, which could ratchet up violence in the region. U.S. officials said this week that Iran appears to be lining up a series of potential retaliations, including direct attacks on Israeli assets within Israel territory or at diplomatic missions, or operations carried out by proxy groups such as Hezbollah in Lebanon and on Israel's northern border and pro-Iranian militias in Iraq. Iran is threatening to launch a major attack on Israel, President Joe Biden said Thursday. "Our commitment to Israel's safety in the face of these threats from Iran and its allies is unwavering," British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, expressed similar thoughts. "Threats by Iran are inadmissible.
he said. The trigger for the latest Israel-Iran standoff is the April 1st bombing of an Iranian building adjacent to the Iranian embassy in Damascus, in which 7 high-ranking Iranian military officials from the Islamic Republican Guard were killed. Israel has neither confirmed nor denied responsibility. Iran maintains the attack on its diplomatic mission violated international law. U.S. officials say regardless of whether the building had diplomatic status, it was being used to conduct what they call terrorist operations targeting Israel from Lebanon. The evil regime, in brackets, Israel, made a mistake and must be punished, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, K-H-A-M-E-N-E-I, said this week. Biden administration officials are not pleased to see the latest tensions, which come as Israel and Palestinian militant group Hamas are attempting to negotiate a ceasefire in Gaza. Below this article, over to the right, over to the left now, is one titled House OK's Renewal of Surveillance Program by the Associated Press, Washington. The House voted Friday to reauthorize and reform a key U.S. government surveillance tool following a dramatic showdown on the floor over whether the FBI should be restricted from using the program to search for Americans' data. The bill was approved on a bipartisan basis, 273-147, though it still will have to clear the Senate to become law. The surveillance program is set to expire April 19th unless Congress acts. Passage of the bill represented a much-needed victory for Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, who has been wrangling with conservative critics of the legislation for months. A group of 19 Republicans revolted to block the bill from coming to the floor earlier this week, forcing Johnson to make late changes to secure their support. The legislation approved Friday would extend the surveillance program for 2 years rather than the full 5 years authorization first proposed. Johnson hoped that the shorter timeline would sway GOP critics by pushing any future debate to the presidency of Donald Trump if he were to win in November. Still, the legislation teetered precariously Friday morning as lawmakers voted on an amendment posed by Johnson, the White House, and sponsors of the legislation that would have prohibited the warrantless surveillance of Americans. One of his top critics, Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, said that Johnson's vote against the warrant requirement was another strike against him. Basically, what's the difference in Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Speaker Johnson? And there's not one, said the Georgia lawmaker said. The amendment failed by the narrowest of margins in a 212-212 tie. The vote on the amendment cut across party lines, uniting progressives and conservatives who agree on little else, but have long been skeptical of the government's surveillance powers. In a surprise move after the vote was closed on the bill, a Republican made a procedural motion preventing the legislation from being sent to the Senate. An additional vote will be needed next week. The legislation approved Friday would permit the U.S. government to collect, without a warrant, the communications of non-Americans outside the country to gather foreign intelligence. The reauthorization is tied to a series of reforms aimed at satisfying critics who complained of civil liberties violations against Americans. To the right of this article is another titled One Dead, 13 Hurt After Intentional Crash. Semi-trailer rams into Texas Public Safety Building. Article by the Associated Press, Brenham, Texas. Texas semi-trailer driver rammed a stolen 18-wheeler through the front of a public safety building where his renewal for a commercial driver's license had been rejected, killing one person and injuring 13 others, authorities said Friday. The intentional crash into the single-story brick building of a highway in Brenham, a rural town outside Houston, littered debris in the parking lot and left a gaping hole in the entrance. The crash damaged the front of this red semi-trailer, which was hauling materials on a flatbed. After crashing into the building the first time, the driver backed up the truck with the intention of smashing it again before being detained, Brenna Mayor Atwood Kinjura said. The driver, identified as Clennard Parker, 42, was pulled out of the truck by authorities at the Texas Department of Public Safety office. Authorities say Parker did not resist when he was taken into custody and would face multiple felony charges. On Thursday, Parker was told by employees at the office that he would not be eligible to renew his commercial driver's license. Texas Department of Public Safety Sergeant Justin Ruiz said. Sorry, I apologize. R-U-I-Z. He did not elaborate as to why Parker's renewal was rejected. There's a photo of the damage taken after this first story, sort of brick-ish building with like a garage near the front. There's like rubble on the ground and broken fencing and pipe and like bars on the side that have also looked broken. And the 18-wheeler is sort of smushed and covered in rubble too. It's captioned, a stolen 18-wheeler crashed into a Texas Department of Public Safety office Friday in Brenham, Texas. The final article of this page A4 is titled EU Regulators, No Link Between Ozempic and Suicide. I think it's Ozempic, O-Z-E-M-P-I-C, article by the Associated Press. Drug regulators in Europe have found no evidence that popular diabetes and weight loss drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy are linked to a higher risk of suicidal thoughts or actions. The European Medicines Agency announced the results of its review Friday. It's the latest group to conclude there's no known tie between a new class of obesity drugs and suicide. In January, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration said a preliminary review showed no evidence of such a link, though the agency said it could not rule out that a small risk may exist, that it would continue to study the issue. The review by EU regulators was triggered last July by anecdotal reports that people taking the drugs had thoughts of self-harm. A5 is Insight articles, which I think are like opinion pages. The one in the top left-hand corner is titled The Gazette's Editorial, A Monument to Bipartisanship. Persistence paid off for Cedar Rapids leaders who have been lobbying for years to win funding for a new 8th Avenue bridge that will fit into the city's flood control system. Last week came the announcement that federal dollars will provide $56.4 million for the project, or 80% of its cost. The city will come up with matching funds for the $76.1 million project to build the Arc of Justice Bridge. As severe weather events intensify, the Arc of Justice Bridge will stand as a symbol of our work to shape a future where every community member can thrive, said Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell in a statement welcoming the federal funding. Funding was made possible through bipartisan cooperation in Congress, and U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican for Iowa, deserves considerable credit. President Joe Biden's bipartisan infrastructure law provided the funding. Grassley was the lone member of the state's all-Republican congressional delegation to support the law. Grassley clearly does not see eye to eye with Biden on most issues, but the senator understands he represents a state with major infrastructure needs. Grassley's vote came with some political risk as Donald Trump and other Republicans shunned GOP members of Congress who supported the bill. Grassley picked leadership over partisan politics, so Cedar Rapids and other Iowa communities could benefit. The new 8th Avenue Bridge will be elevated to provide another crucial route across the Cedar River during major flooding. The single pier designed to improve the flow of the river is expected to have a 100-year lifespan. Its tall central pier and cable support structure also will be a striking addition to the city's skyline. Construction of the new bill is expected to begin in 2027. Construction of the new bridge is expected to begin in 2027, coordinated both with the completion of West Side flood protection and East Side flood control being carried out by the Army Corps of Engineers. This project holds significance for the entire community. I am incredibly proud of the team effort. Our perseverance has paid off, City Manager Jeff Pomerantz said in a statement. The bridge also will stand as a monument to what can be accomplished when partisan politics is put aside in the best interests of Iowans. Beneath this is the community letters. Choose candidates who represent all of us. In recent years, I've become increasingly concerned about the behavior and intentions of the Republican leaders who have led our state. It's been increasingly evident that their goal is to rule rather than govern, to the point that it makes sense to refer to our current state leadership as a regime pursuing its own interests and goals at the expense of its subjects. But haven't they won all those elections? Yes, true enough. But if you look at their margins of victory, they are usually received about 3 out of every 5 votes. But what of the needs and values of the 40% of voters who oppose Republican policies? Have our current rulers made any effort to listen to the negligible 2 out of 5 voting Iowans who consistently disagree with them? Isn't democratic government supposed to be based on mutual respect and, in some cases, compromise? It's clear that Republicans' majority has gone to their head, as it's further manifested in their attempts to limit local decision-making by increasing the governor's power, as if the governor will always be a Republican and one party is here to stay. But change will come if we are able to increase the already positive vision of 40% of voters to 51% or more. Some heavy lifting is required, but it can be done, and if you want to see this happen, speak to your neighbors and support candidates who will work to represent all of us. Article by Harvey Solberger from Strawberry Point. Below this is another editorial by syndicated columnist Lenore Skenazy. We are the reason kids are on screens. Errant, sorry, but this culture is driving me nuts. It is blind to the idea that kids can and in recent history have done some things on their own, no parents involved, and this was good, even healthy. But one screen time specialist just emailed me with this helpful tip on how to get kids off their phone. Have families come up with non-screen activities? I emailed back, like what? Her reply, together plan a trip to a science museum and look up the exhibits you want to see. Why is this making my heart pound like a near-miss car crash? 1. There is simply no notion of the idea that kids can or should spend any time not doing something educational. Make every moment a lesson, enriching, teachable. Maybe they can write their college essay about it. 2. Her idea works one time for one afternoon, making it seem as if any non-screen time requires daylight planning. 3. The parent now has a new duty, which is to help organize, totally organize, an outing and then accompany their kid on it. Any gads, the money this requires, the tickets, the parking, the gas, the gift shop, and the healthy snacks you must sleep, and if you work, the time you must take off. Surely your boss will understand and compensate you, right? Your child needs a screen-free afternoon. There is zero mention of, heck, kids have entertained themselves forever. Send them outside and they'll come up with something to do. Give them a flip phone or a walkie-talkie if you're worried. And not so short, we have disappeared a normal childhood, complete with adventures, misadventures, boredom, free play, and poking around. Even screen time experts can't imagine kids doing something that is not on a screen, but not a parent-supervised something or other either. An 80s childhood, come home when the streetlights go on, down the memory hole. Well, no wonder kids are on phones. That is the only place we let them play and wander without us. And no wonder we let them scroll. For parents, phones are the only alternative to a one-family education stuffed infinitely fascinating daycare center run by you for your own kid. So, screen time experts, worried parents, and everyone working to break the hold that phones have on kids, take heed. No Kids will get off phones if the only alternative is intensive parent-led adult-supervised activities, because no parent will have the time, ability, or desire to make that happen on any sustainable basis. Life is not a constant field trip. Let Grow, which I run, is the only organization I know that is trying to make it normal to let kids do some things on their own, unsupervised. It's strange that no one else is flying this flag. They should. Because until we succeed, kids will spend most of their childhoods in the virtual world. And it's our fault for not giving them the other one, the real world, to enjoy with their friends without us. Article is by Lenore Skenazy. Lenore Skenazy is a syndicated columnist distributed by Creators. Then, to the right of this is a guest column by Rob Sand titled, Bird Must Provide Help for Sexual Assault Victims. Lots of topics get swept under the rug because they're not comfortable for us to confront. Sometimes we'd rather pretend the problems don't exist or couldn't happen in a place like Iowa. But they do, and it can happen anywhere, even in our great state. It is our obligation to confront them in order to solve them. I've always spoken out on behalf of victims of sexual violence. From my time as a prosecutor putting or keeping rapists and pedophiles behind bars, to voting against taxpayer-funded settlements that bail out perpetrators of egregious sexual harassment in my role as a member of the State Appeal Board now that I'm State Auditor. The month of April marks Sexual Assault Awareness Month. The National Sexual Violence Resource Center provides a number of tools to help raise awareness of sexual assault and prevent it from happening in the first place. So let's confront another uncomfortable topic. Since her term began, Iowa's Attorney General Brenna Byrd cut off funding for emergency contraception for rape victims. It is hard to believe, but read that sentence again. The majority of the program's participants are Iowa children and teenagers. This has nothing to do with abortion. Emergency contraception, in fact, must be taken quickly after a rape to prevent pregnancy. Her refusal to support rape victims literally makes my skin crawl. In addition to avoid accountability, the Attorney General is claiming there's an audit underway. I'm her auditor. That's not true. She might be having someone in her office concoct some twisted memo to try to justify her decision, but that's not an audit. Protecting victims and providing support for people who've experienced an unspeakable crime shouldn't be a partisan idea. Political considerations didn't cross my mind when I was prosecuting sex offenders at the Attorney General's office. For the vast majority of hardworking people in law enforcement, that's still true. But the Attorney General's decision to stop providing payments for emergency contraception is exactly that. It reminds me of why so many Iowans turn away from politics and how we hate what it does to people who seek power. The Attorney General says she's unsure whether taxpayer funds should be used for this purpose, except the funds weren't coming from taxes. The money comes from fines paid by offenders found guilty of crimes. Iowans are fair-minded. We want justice for those wronged. During Sexual Assault Awareness Month, we should all recommit ourselves to finding care and consideration for people who've been through trauma and tragedy. The Attorney General should stop hiding behind make-believe audits and political games and restore funding for emergency contraception. To learn more about Sexual Assault Awareness Month and why, and ways you can help prevent this crime from happening, visit nfvrc.org. Rob Sand is Iowa's State Auditor. There's a comic and a political cartoon on this page. One is by cartoonist Michael Ramirez for the Creator Syndicate. It's an elephant in like an evening gown with a big sort of like Kentucky Derby kind of wide-brimmed hat. On top of it, it's like a dodo or like some kind of vulture. I think it's a dodo sitting inside like the flowers on the hat. And it might be saying, oust the speaker, disrobe the judge, space lasers in the gazpacho police. And the elephant with this hat, speaking to a little girl. It's asking her, "It's the latest thing from Marjorie Taylor Greene. What do you think?" The little girl is saying, "It makes you look stupid." That's that. And moving on to page A6, the largest article is one about, it's the one about the electric buses. The one below it is titled, It's titled, "Iowa Supreme Court Justice Recuses Himself Over Claims of Past Affair. Man Appealing Divorce Says Ex-Wife Had Affair Years Ago," by Caleb McCullough for the Gazette, Gazette Lee Des Moines Bureau, Des Moines. "An Iowa Supreme Court justice had recused himself from the appeal of a pending divorce case if it claims he had an extramarital affair with the woman in the divorce more than a decade ago, according to court records. Iowa Supreme Court Justice Christopher McDonald granted an order to recuse himself in response to a motion filed by John Mordini, who is appealing the terms of a divorce proceedings with his ex-wife. John Mordini appealed a Polk County District Court's decision April 9th. In the motion asking for the recusal, which was filed the same day as the appeal, John Mordini stated that his ex-wife, Nikki Mordini, an immigration and family law lawyer, was involved in an affair during the time of their marriage with McDonald, long before he was appointed to the state Supreme Court in 2019. The affair had a significant negative impact on the marriage and ultimately contributed to the breakdown in the bonds of matrimony," his motion stated. The motion further states that Nikki Mordini met with McDonald in summer 2023 after she filed for divorce and discussed that John Mordini knew of the affair. It would be impossible for the appellant to believe he would have been given fair consideration by Justice McDonald given the aforementioned facts and events," the motion states. McDonald filed an order the same day granting the motion and recusing himself with no additional detail. Then on Thursday, he filed an amended order. The amended order said the recusal was based upon a personal relationship between McDonald and Nikki Mordini that occurred more than a decade ago. Steve Davis, a spokesperson for the Iowa Judicial Branch, said McDonald was unable to provide further comment. He said the Iowa Code of Judicial Conduct prevents judges, justices, and court staff from commenting on pending cases. The Code of Judicial Conduct states that justices should recuse themselves when their impartiality might be reasonably questioned, including when the judge has a personal bias or prejudice concerning a party or party's lawyer, among other circumstances. A lawyer representing Nikki Mordini declined to comment. John Mordini could not be reached by phone Friday. The Polk County District Court granted the divorce between John and Nikki Mordini on March 22nd, about a year after Nikki Mordini initially filed for it. Nikki Mordini owns a law practice in Des Moines, and John Mordini is self-employed in construction. They were married in 2003. Court records show McDonald was divorced in 2009. He later served on the Court of Appeals from 2013 to 2019, having been a district court judge and in private practice before that. McDonald was appointed to the Supreme Court by Republican Kim Reynolds. He is now married and has three children, according to the Iowa Supreme Court website. And there's a photo of Iowa Supreme Justice Christopher McDonald. He's shaking hands with Kim Reynolds as he's taking his oath into office. He has sort of a beard and close-cropped hair, and I think he's wearing glasses, and he's wearing, like, a suit and tie, and he's shaking hands with Kim Reynolds, also wearing a suit and tie, and she has a bob. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. I'm your reader, Catherine Davis. Again, if you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at 515-243-6833. That's 515-243-6833. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.